I will call to order the March 15th meeting of the Government Operations and Elections Committee. And the first order of business that we have is the approval of the minutes from the meeting of March 14th. Representative Bliss, have you had a chance to review those minutes and be willing to move them this morning?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move those minutes.
Representative Bliss moves the minutes from March 14th. Any questions, objections, corrections? Seeing none and hearing none, the motion prevails. Our first bill on the agenda, Representative Luke, if you'll make your way to the testifiers table. Our first bill this morning is House File 3280, and I will move House File 3280 before the committee to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Lewick, welcome to the committee. If you will go ahead and introduce your bill, and then we will proceed from there. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members of the committee. House File 3280 deals with rulemaking, obviously. That's why it's here. And what it would do is primarily provide an opportunity for MPCA to restart a process that we've been working on for about 8 years to replace a standard that sulfate water quality standard that is proven to be one that's obsolete. There's no disagreement on that. It needs to be replaced. It's become problematic in actually coming up with the science that everybody can resolve or be satisfied with, including our administrative law judge folks. So, and we spent a full committee hearing session, Environmental Services, discussing the aspects of the details of sulfate standards and impacts. So I'm here just to primarily to talk about what we're doing here is basically asking MPCA to go back, start that rulemaking process over again. Right now, the current one is involved in a appeals process with the administrative law judge folks. And there's additional issues in here that provides guidance to the agency on where they can and can't apply the existing standard. Again, that's not a rulemaking issue. So, you know, with that, you know, unless the chair wants to get into the details of the guts of the bill, which are not to do with rulemaking, it's just a matter of it deals with rulemaking. We're basically going to there's a deadline for MPCA to complete some rulemaking. We're going to remove that deadline, so that gives them the flexibility and the time to work through this. Again, we've been working on this for 8 years, and to have a deadline out there and beginning of next year, we know that's not going to work. There's testifiers here that could speak to the impact on communities. It's probably not necessary here because we're talking specifically rulemaking, but if that's necessary, they're certainly available. But at this point, I'd be open for questions, and I do believe we've got MPCA is available to speak to their part of this, because obviously they're deeply involved in this rulemaking process.
Representative Lewick, thank you for the setup on the bill. Members, as Representative Lewick indicated, and as this committee is very accustomed to, many bills come before us that have rulemaking or other changes in structure of government. And for the discussions today, the bill that we are looking at, House File 3280, those that are within the purview of this committee are Sections 3, 4, and 5 dealing with rulemaking and the guidelines for promulgation of those rules, as well as the identification of the areas. So, Representative Nelson, you do have a question. I will go to you, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to point that out. But isn't Section 9 also the creation of the working group? That's part of our purview also. So, I mean, yeah. But other than that, other than rulemaking and setting up the work group, I don't think anything else in the bill is in our committee.
They may have also already had Representative Nelson the ability to do a working group. We don't have to statutorily do that, but certainly with that as a part of the bill and a part of the conversation, I don't think anybody's going to object to a working group or have many issues on that. With that, members, are there any general questions before we go? And again, I do want to keep it to the purview of the committee on rulemaking. This had been, if I could use the term, extensively litigated in the Environment Committee previously. Our domain is the rulemaking as the government operations area. Members, I see no other questions at this time. Did you have some testifiers that you'd like to, or did you want me to open it up, Representative Lewick?
I would open it up. I believe that if MPCA has an interest in testifying, obviously this does certainly deal with their area of expertise.
Well, since you suggested them and they do are a major player in this bill, is there anyone from the MPCA that would like to testify on the matter before the committee this morning? Anybody from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency? Looks like we've got a taker making his way to the testifying table. Good morning, sir. I don't think we have had the opportunity to meet previously. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name, and my assumption is you are with the MPCA, but we'll ask you to state that and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Adonis Snublet. I'm General Counsel at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The Pollution Control Agency has been immersed in going through the rulemaking process. We've had many hearings. We have exchanged communications with the administrative law judge. We've received the report, which was extensive, and we are in the process of working through and preparing a response to the administrative law judge. And we are going to continue to work with the administrative law judge following the processes that were set out in statute to try to move from the disapprovals that we have to an approval. And consequently, now I have no specific comments on behalf of the agency relative to the statute, or proposed statute.
Well, thank you for being with us today and sharing the position at this time of the MPCA.
Well, thank you.
Representative Mason, a question for the testifier.
I do, as long as I have, I guess it would be for both of them. I'm looking
Sir,
at section.
Representative Mason has a question. You may want to stick close by here. Representative Mason. Testifier is trying to go find a friend to help him with the answer to your question. He didn't even know what it was at that point. So,
okay, Mr. Chair. Section 3, it has to do with the water quality standard. And it's, to me, it's pretty strict, so I'm just wondering both of your, how you interpret this. The commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency may not adopt, modify, or proceed with any revisions with rules pertaining to the water quality standards. That, to me, is quite dramatic.
So would you like to respond to that, or Representative Lewick?
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as we are involved in the midst of this rulemaking process, PCA has no specific comment with respect to the language in the bill.
Representative Lewick?
And if I could add, if you'll note, basically that at the most would provide for, if we have to start all over, then we got to start all over at the beginning. That's basically, if you look at the very last 3.2122, it takes us back to the beginning, because believe me, this has been a very extended rulemaking process, It does not. It just says, "Look, go back. Let go back and start at point A if we do have to do this over again."
Representative Mason, follow up.
No, thank you.
We'll revert to Representative Freiberg for his question. Representative Freiberg,
thank you. Question for the bill author: the bill would prohibit the commissioner from adopting any rules that are part of the decision of the administrative law judge of January 11th without going through a separate rulemaking process first. I know there's a standard practice. I think where there is a ALJ decision, I think the MPCA has 180 days to respond, and then there's a counter response. This would kind of short-circuit that process. I'm just wondering if that is common, that's where the legislature short-circuits the process, and if there are other examples of where that has occurred.
Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, what we want to make sure happens here, and this is something we talk about frequently over in Environmental Natural Resources Committee, with the, not just NPCA, but also the DNR. What can happen is a applicant that has a permit that's under review on a five-year schedule is, for better or for worse, in anticipation of rules coming online in the future. And I mean, I'm talking about anticipation. I'm not talking about a rule that's actually been completed. There'll be a negotiation starts over, well, let's go ahead and let's adopt this because in the future you're probably going to have to comply with it anyway. And that is just very specifically to stop that and not get in a situation where we're negotiating on a permit application to renew it on things that are not yet settled, and because that gets into money, it gets into time. It's also it complicates things both for the agency and the applicant. So that's what that's about. Is until we've got settled rules, let's not be in any way, shape, or form trying to get ahead of the game, because until we see what the rule is, it's not fair to either side to go down the road of trying to assume what's going to happen in the future.
Representative Freiberg, follow-up?
Not this time.
Seeing no other member questions at this time, I've just been asked by staff if you could give us your first name again, your last name, and the spelling for the record.
My name is Adonis Neblett. First name, A-D-O-N-I-S, last name, Neblett, N-E-B-L-E-T-T.
Mr. Neblett, thank you for being here with us today. If you want to just stand by, there may be some other questions that the department may wish to respond to.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 3280? And we are in our purview are Sections 3, 4, 5, and 9. Anyone else present wishing to testify on the matter before? Sir, make your way to the testifying table if you would. Mm-hmm. And again, if there's anyone else who is interested in testifying, we'll just ask you to make sure you check in and sign with Santa, our page, and she will get you queued up, because we do have a rather robust agenda and we want to make sure we get everybody heard and get our committee business resolved today. So again, if there's others that would like to testify, we'll ask you to get checked in. Good morning, sir. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is David Patton, D-A-V-I-D-P-A-T-T-O-N. First name like the king, second name like the general.
This is not the first time you've used that line. I am sure of that. Mr. Patton, please. Continue through your testimony.
I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. We're a public interest environmental law and science organization headquartered here in St. Paul, and we have been involved in these disputes for a long time. We oppose the bill for at least two reasons. One is that it doesn't create regulatory certainty as it's promised. Under federal law, the existing water quality standard can't just be abandoned or nullified as this bill attempts to do. There's a process for changing the standard under federal law. Secondly, although the bill purports to respect the science and to support the ALJ decision, in actuality, it ignores the specific finding of an equation-based standard that was that the ALJ found to be scientifically reasonable and protective of wild rice. And although the bill acts as a giveaway to industry polluters and would leave Minnesota's wild rice unprotected for the foreseeable future, I'm going to confine my testimony to the purview of this committee. MCEA opposes this bill because it usurps the role of state agencies to enforce our laws, and it interferes with the ongoing administrative process. This bill is being presented as a path to regulatory certainty, but interrupting the rulemaking will only lead to chaos. The bill nullifies the numeric sulfate standard, the so-called 10 standard from the Minnesota rules. And the state, whether by rule or by law, cannot undo a water quality standard that's been approved by the US EPA unless it substitutes a valid water quality standard that is at least as protective, which is what the PCA was trying to do. Until the EPA approves a new standard, the Clean Water Act, federal law, requires MPCA to implement the current standard. This bill indefinitely, under Section 1, extends the rulemaking process and includes a targeted attempt to nullify the current standard. This is going to leave MPCA between a rock and a hard place, because state law is going to forbid them from enforcing the standard, and federal law is going to require them to enforce the standard. There's already a petition pending with the EPA to de-delegate Clean Water Authority from Minnesota, which would mean Minnesota doesn't issue federal water permits. So this bill does the opposite of what it purports to accomplish. It's going to lead to greater regulatory uncertainty, the only certainty being that this thing is going to be litigated. Secondly, this bill misinterprets fundamentally the ALJ decision on the wild rice standard and undermines MPCA's ability to develop a science-based, evidence-supported standard that is protective of Minnesota's unique wild rice. The bill interferes with rulemaking by forbidding PCA to use the equation-based standard, which it developed based on the studies done by the University of Minnesota. Although the ALJ objected to the plan for implementing the new sulfate standard, she specifically found that the science underlying the standard was reasonable and protective of wild rice. Here, reading from paragraph 257 of the ALJ decision, the administrative law judge finds that the MPCA's demonstration that the science underlying the equation-based standard is reasonable in that it describes a manner of calculating a sulfate level resulting in a level of sulfide in pore water protective of wild rice. That's what the ALJ decided. The science is good. It's the implementation that needs work. PCA has done the work to develop an equation that's supported by the evidence and science. Currently, the PCA's options include fixing the implementation in the process that was outlined, working with the ALJ, fixing the parts that the ALJ didn't like, using the science, or going back to start using the science. But this bill would short-circuit that and would force them to eject the science. This bill attempts to gut the existing standard and wastes millions of dollars of public money that resulted in a science-based standard. The EPA, even our diminished EPA under President Trump, isn't going to approve such an obvious undoing of a protective water quality standard. As a final note, MCA does support Section 9, which asks for additional study to be authorized and funded. Thank you so much for the time to share with you guys and the opportunity to share the views of MCA here today, Mr. Chairman. That concludes
Mr. Patton,
my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. I have no member questions at this time for you. Oh, I do, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Patton, I was trying to get a better understanding of the role that the state and the federal government play right now. So is it possible that Minnesota could possibly lose some of our power to issue water permits here in the state?
Yeah, the way the federal environmental laws work is that there's an overarching federal law that then delegates to the states to enforce it. So currently a Minnesota project would apply for a permit in Minnesota that would include the federal permit. So it's a one permit deal. If that ability was removed as the de-delegation petition, it's a formal legal petition that was filed with the EPA, if that were adopted, then folks would have to get a state permit and a separate federal permit. And the EPA is taking this seriously. They reached out to the Attorney General of Minnesota and asked for an opinion as to whether the MPCA was still capable of issuing federal permits. And the AG found that they were only because there was a deadline on the rulemaking, which this bill removes. So it's really going to call into question Minnesota's federal authority.
Representative Lee? All right. Is there anyone else who has questions for the testifiers? Representative Joachim.
Sorry, I was running a little bit late. Mine was more directed toward the author, so I can wait.
We can go to the author. I don't think I have any other questions for the testifier, so if you'd like to go to the author. And again, if anyone else is interested in testifying, we'll just ask you to make your way forward at this time. Representative Joachim, to
thank
the author.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for
Mr. Patton, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lewick, thank you for taking on this pretty heavy issue. I know it's been a lot of time and energy and money has gone into studying this, and it's very important. And what we are hearing today and what we've heard before in other committees, I had a chance to listen to some of them, is that the underlying science is good, but it's complicated. That implementation of the current standard is also complicated, except very complicated. But this is such an important topic to make sure that our waters aren't impaired. and that we figure out a way somehow to implement something that protects our wild rice, which is culturally and economically important to so many areas of Minnesota. And I know that's a heavy lift, and I really do appreciate the inclusion of Section 9. I wish it would have been a more robust task force with fully funded, because it is quite a heavy lift that they're going to have to do to find a way through this. And I hope you'll consider, as this bill moves forward, or reconsider kind of beefing that up. Otherwise, until that happens, I don't think I can be supportive of it. But I just wanted to say thank you for making the attempt.
Representative Lewick.
Well, thank you. If I could just very briefly comment on the previous testifiers. Leadership here in Minnesota within the legislation has had conversations with regional EPA director in Chicago very recently to discuss this whole issue of this particular standard, and I was not on that conference call, but I've had conversations with the people that were, and the director there in Chicago of what Region 5, I guess it is very clear that they're interested in what we're doing, very specifically with this circumstance. They understand the difference between a narrative standard and a numerical standard. And again, we talked about this at great length for an entire session. What we're doing is shifting to a narrative standard, not unlike what we have for a wetland. We've got a big picture narrative standard that says the state of Minnesota will have no net loss of wetlands. Basically, that's the approach, and that's what the last section of this bill starts again, because here is 117 pages that 8 years ago fell apart and got stalled on what we should have been doing. And this was a report done by the DNR. So while it's a heavy lift, that working group can pick this 117 pages up, go right back to the original recommendations, which you'll find in this. They're basically findings that we're reminding everybody again. We already had this figured out as to the route we needed to go, and that was to focus on protecting wild rice the same way we do wetlands. So, again, that's just to make sure that you hear the rest of the story on where federal EPA fits into this. But to get back to your question specifically on Section 9, that's still a piece that's in process yet. In fact, I'll be meeting tomorrow with at least one commissioner for one of the bands in my area, DNR commissioner, to talk about how we can jumpstart something that fell off the rails. This is a big book that's got a lot of smart stuff to do about fixing things on wild rice, why it fell off the rails 8 years ago and why we're not back on it. So 80% of that heavy lifting is right here. We just got to pick it up and go back to work on it.
Representative Lewick, I fully hear and feel your passion in the bill. I'm going to ask you to make your responses as long as or shorter than the question asked. And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but no, we've been on this topic for about 25 minutes, and the committee at this time of the year has a very robust calendar. We do want to be fair to everybody that's in here. Representative Joachim, follow-up? I see no other testifiers from the public that want to testify. Representative Sandstead, you are the last person and member that I have on our list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, is it a fair statement basically to say that this bill, we're not here to debate the merits and the findings, but this bill is really going to act as a vehicle to get parties on both sides of this extremely polarized issue back to the table to get it right, because even though the ALJ's findings, or the ALJ stated the MPCA's findings were the science was reasonable, we know it's not absolutely comprehensive, and we know that there are other factors that we have to take into account. And I think both parties know that, and I've heard a commitment from both sides that they're ready to go back. There's too much at stake for both sides not to get this right, and this vehicle is really, or this bill really acts as a vehicle to go back and reset the timetable so we can work and get it right.
Mm-hmm. Representative Sandstead, thank you for your testimony, your comments. Representative Lewis, we will give you the final word.
I would say I agree 100% with Representative Sandstead, and brevity is our friend here, Mr. Chair. I got to come back to this committee several times. So
the rules continue to apply forward, just for whatever that's worth. that I will renew my motion that House File 3280 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Representative Lewis, you are on your way. Representative Knobloch, I will move House File 1843 before the committee. To possibly include it with in the omnibus elections bill this year. With that, I see that it is before the committee, and as I say, we'll be laying it over for possible inclusion. There are a couple of different amendments that are in the bill. I'll give you a chance to set up, and if any of those are yours that you'd like to move at this time to get the bill in the shape you'd like, we will take those as well. Chair Knobloch, welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd appreciate it if you'd move the A5 amendment. The A5 amendment is primarily a technical amendment that conforms to other changes that have already been made in the bill. But the one substantial part of it is, as people know right now, for those who sign up for the public subsidy, there is a party account and a non-party account in terms of checks you get. And since this is a nonpartisan bill, people would no longer get the party account money, so this boosts up the non-party account money that people would get. And that's what the amendment does.
Representative and Chair Knobloch, I will move the A5 amendment to House File 1843, which is the author's intentions. All those in favor of the A5 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author desires, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the bill is before us in the form you want. Proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1843 is a historic bill. It requires state legislative candidates to run for office without a political party listed to their next to their name on the ballot. State legislative candidates would run for office just like most mayors, county commissioners, city councilors, and school board members run today. Minnesota state legislative elections were actually run this way from 1911 to the mid-1970s. Minnesota is one of two states, the other being Nebraska, that have a long experience of nonpartisan legislative elections, and Nebraska still does them today. Why do I suggest this? Four reasons. First, I believe that excessive partisanship sometimes gets in the way of accomplishing things. I often see ideas from one side swiftly rejected by the other just because of the other party is suggesting it. And I also sometimes seen ideas that are not given the scrutiny that is deserved because the idea came from our side. Second, I believe it would curb the power of special interests. They would no longer be able to rely as much on the relationship with the party or caucus leader, whichever party that might be, but would now have to convince more people to accomplish their will. Third, I believe it would reduce the negativity of campaigns. You don't generally see the level of negativity in local races like mayor and city council that you see in state legislative races. This would encourage more people to run for office. And finally, I think it would produce better legislation. It is, in my view, tempting for members to get lazy around here and just vote the party line. If there was less of a party line, there would be more independent thought and better legislation. And in exercising more independent thought, members would become better legislators. It is natural to ask, how could this work? How would the legislature be organized? Who would choose the committee chairs? First, of course, it worked for over 60 years already here, so it certainly can work. Regarding legislative organization, Minnesota had no majority and minority caucuses right after the 1911 change, only individual members. Some decades later, it organized into conservative and liberal caucuses. However, historically, there were a number of primarily rural Democrats who were part of the conservative caucus, and a number of primarily Metro Republicans who were part of the Liberal Caucus. Conservatives and liberals were not just other words back then for Republicans and Democrats. Nebraska, on the other hand, has for decades and still today has not two but three caucuses. Those three caucuses are one caucus for each of their three congressional districts. Regarding committee chairs, Nebraska legislators elect their committee chairs instead of having them appointed. Historically, it is not unusual for a committee chair from what would be considered the minority to be elected based on their expertise, seniority, and reputation for fairness. Finally, I believe there could be some financial savings because we would no longer need separate partisan research staffs who, let's face it, frankly tend to reinforce people's partisan leanings, but could instead simply rely on nonpartisan research. During the 60 years that Minnesota had a nonpartisan legislature, it went from being an average, undistinguished Midwestern state to being one of the leading states in the nation. I do not think this just happened on its own. I think the nonpartisan form of government and the better laws it produced was one of the reasons for this. In closing, I would refer you to a handout from the foreword of the book, The Minnesota Legislature of 1919, which can be found in the legislative library upstairs. And you should all have that handout. Looks like this. If you turn to the other page in the back, it says, and I kind of highlighted this area, I'll quote just a little bit of it. In 1911, the legislature was made nonpartisan. Members have been more free to use their individual judgment. An honest, intelligent member is better off without a party boss or caucus, and it is safe to say that the nonpartisan election has resulted in a better and more independent group of men coming to the legislature. Now, of course, it says men, but if you read on a little bit, you'll see it talks about women's suffrage being one of the big issues of the day, and I think that in the session following this particular one, women's suffrage was adopted in Minnesota. But members, I urge your support for this historic bill, and I would stand for questions.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can respond to a couple of comments. First of all, I remember a number of years ago when I was at a political event, there was a man that came up to me and said he was one of the people, along with the League of Women Voters, that moved us to identify parties because he said the population is getting so large that it's really hard for people to to know their representatives. So this way, at least if you have a party, you have some idea of how somebody is going to vote. And then also, I used to be on the Deakin City Council. And for many years, and there were both parties on the council, it was truly nonpartisan. But I would say towards the middle of the 90s, a couple of the members who actually happened to be Republican, they started making their comments and bringing in the party when they were on the dais. So I'm thinking, your comments about local government being nonpartisan, they're certainly elected that way, but over the last couple of decades, we have seen people that no longer honor the nonpartisan portion of their office. And that, to me, is wrong, but that's the way it is.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just briefly say, first of all, in terms of this argument that people won't know how to vote if they don't see a party name behind someone's name on the ballot, obviously people are already making choices for who they're voting for mayor, city council, county commissioner, school board. Those don't have party names next to the ballot. And, with the Internet and such today, I think there's even more resources to research the positions of people. So I guess maybe that was a valid argument, a long time ago, but I guess I don't really see that as that important of an argument today. And you're right, Representative Mason. I mean, people still are going to have political opinions. People have different opinions. We're not going to get rid of that. Some are going to be more forceful while pushing their particular party's views than others. This doesn't get rid of the endorsement process. If someone wants to get an endorsement from a party and use that, people have freedom of speech and they can use it. But I think this would, for the reasons I mentioned, be a better thing for our legislature.
Representative Mason, follow-up?
No, thank you very much.
We have Representative Pearson followed by Representative Halverson. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Knobloch. First, I have a question. So did you say that Nebraska's caucus is determined by congressional district?
Representative Knobloch.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, yes. Nebraska has three caucuses, one for each congressional district.
Representative Peterson, follow-up.
Yeah, okay, that's interesting. I just wanted to share a story of former Representative Bob Bell's family friend, and he was here in the early 70s when they moved to the DFL Republican caucuses, and he said it was his worst regret. So I just thought I'd pass that along as we're having this conversation, because I think that it is important that we all work together, and being on school board where it is nonpartisan, to be honest, party didn't get in the way in that body, but I think that we all know, like in Minneapolis, it does, for example. But on the other hand, you know, it was conservative and liberal. So there's still going to be, I think, the ideology changes. I guess the question is will our public get educated enough to make sure that their candidates reflect the values that they have to go vote? And that is that is our constituents' job, to learn more about the candidates who are running. So I don't know if you have any further comment on that, Representative Knobloch, but that's my comments.
Representative Knobloch.
No, thank you, Representative Peterson. I know my former state senator, Keith Hughes, who was here during those days, also has always felt it was a mistake to make the switch. I was hoping to have him testify, but he's down south in a warmer climate.
Rochester? Representative Halverson, followed by Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's interesting that we want to be a state like the great state of Nebraska. I'm kind of proud of being the great state of Minnesota. My grandfather actually served in the nonpartisan legislature for over 10 years, both in the House and in the Senate, and talked a lot to me about, he can't testify, he's passed away, but about the way that the party's organized without party designation. I threw up some air quotes there, because they actually did organize themselves into factions, and I use that word, actually, it's a word James Madison used when he was defending the new Constitution when it was being ratified, because there was a lot of concern about people forming political parties in this new government, and the fact that there were people who were advocating that we not have political parties and political designations, and early on technically they didn't, although they were Federalists and Anti-Federalists, and what Madison argued was that people naturally form themselves into cohorts and into these factions, and that there's not a whole lot that governments can do about people organizing themselves that way. It tends to be human nature. Think about the way, the places that people gather with people that they want to discuss with or like-minded. People even move into neighborhoods because they all like the same kind of design, if you will. So Madison really argued that this is there's very little government could do about people organizing themselves this way. However, what he argued was that we can, as a government, have influence over the way that these factions influence policymaking. And we have done that over the years. And unfortunately, right now, we're in a situation where unfettered amounts of money are pouring into local campaigns, either at partisan campaigns like the state legislature, but also nonpartisan campaigns. If you look at city council races and other county races, there's a lot of money from outside the state that's flowing in that are influencing those elections, influencing the level of partisanship and factionalism, and getting in the way of legislators and leaders interacting with their government. And this, to me, is the way that we can come together and have some influence over the effects of this partisanship, the effects of this outside money, and we could do that if we have the courage. The other thing I think that's really true, and I'm really proud to be from a district that is always considered in the balance, right? Everyone's going to look to my district on election night and see which way did it go. And that, to me, is the secret of making sure that we're representing all people of Minnesota. Not gerrymandering our districts, not having so many safe districts that you only have to work for the people who are going to show up and vote for you. I would hope I would never legislate that way. I love being able to hear from everybody, and it has a great influence on me, and it has a great influence on the way I legislate. That's why I'm on a lot of your bills. And I think that there's ways to work together that are much more transparent than saying we're going to just take off our partisan hats. There's ample opportunity to do that on a daily basis here, and the best legislators do that all the time. So let's set standards for ourselves and make sure that we're living up to what the people are expecting of us. And I think that labels or no labels, we can do much better of controlling the influence of the parties as opposed to just saying we're going to take off our hats and just call it something else.
Representative Halverson, I didn't necessarily hear a question. It might have just been some sharing some thoughts. Am I correct on that? You didn't have a question specifically for the bill author?
Mr. Chair, I really don't have questions
Okay. Because
I had a really great college professor who taught me a lot about partisanship.
Well, very good. Representative Nabok, if you'd like to respond to Representative Halverson's comments, you're certainly welcome to do so, sir.
Well, I just briefly say that, of course, like-minded people here, if we didn't even have parties, or party designation, would still band together to work on different things. But I think that we would, by going forward with this bill, minimize some of the effects I talked about that I think are harmful.
Representative Halverson, can you follow
up? Just for the record, I was raised by a member of the Conservative Caucus of the Minnesota Legislature.
Duly noted. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I should always know to get my hand up before Representative Halverson. She always makes more sense than I'm ever going to make. I want to thank Representative Nablock for bringing this bill forward. I think I understand and appreciate the goal that you're going for. I come from local government, 9 years on a very functioning city council that I used to joke was, you know, local government really is the last bastion of sanity that sometimes functions on a nonpartisan way. Unfortunately, as a Representative Halverson did say, I think outside money is even changing that level of sanctity that we have there. So I appreciate it. We had a kind of a long discussion, and we had a kind of long discussion yesterday about truth in advertising, and that kind of echoes with me on this bill. Just because we're taking away the labels on the outside for everybody out there to see, it really doesn't change what's really happening here. And I know we are trying to do a lot of stuff internally to change those dynamics, to work across the aisle with the Civility Caucus, little other different bipartisan groups. And I think we really need to look more internally because of that, because without structural changes inside, it really is, I'm sorry to say, this bill is just window dressing. It's telling the people outside, like, look, you know, we're not partisan, but our whole structure here is. So maybe the one question I kind of leave you with to think about as we move on with this is, have you thought of about a more internal approach to addressing this versus just, as Representative Halverson said, just telling people we're all taking off our hats? So just some thoughts.
Representative Nablock, to Representative Joachim's
comments. I guess, Mr. Chair, there's certainly, you know, other things that could be done internally with the rules and so forth, but I think that many people have tried many of those things for many years, and I think that a bigger, more encompassing approach is necessary, which is what this bill is.
I have no other member questions at this time. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the committee? Anybody from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the committee? House File 1843 as amended. Seeing none, there are two amendments that have been included in your package. Is anyone wanting to offer the A3 and or the A4 amendment? Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll offer the A3 amendment. If we're going to be doing this, we need to, you know, we had a discussion yesterday on the school board bill that we heard about false advertising and putting out false information. And we've had issues in the past where people have put false information into advertisements that they do for when they're running for office. And so that's what this does, is that if somebody does that, they lose their public subsidy. And that's basically the gist of the amendment.
Representative Nelson, question for you as I'm looking at the amendment real quickly. Who's the adjudicating body to determine if there was false statements made?
Mr. Chair, that would be the Campaign Finance Board.
And what control would the Campaign Finance Board have? Well, I'll get back to that because I want to hear what the author has to say on it as well. Representative Fenton, to the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just have a question for Representative Nelson, if he will yield.
Yep.
Representative Nelson, would this, as this amendment is drafted, would this include, say, illegal coordination between a candidate and party? I think I remember a few cycles back we had some issues with that resulted in a very large campaign fine here in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fenton, no, this does not deal with that issue. This deals with the issue of people putting out false information in their campaign material and putting that out to the public to try and deceive the public and about their candidate, about their opponent, or about themselves. And so that's what this does, and doesn't have anything to do with that issue that we're talking about, where the coordination of campaigns, that is another issue altogether.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to note that illegal coordination between a candidate and a party unit is also very much deceit, and I think that should also be considered if anything like this moves forward.
Representative Nelson, the question that I have on here as it relates to false information, does that also include one's voting record as well, distorting that? Would that be classified under false information? So, for example, if you voted for legislation in 1 year and then something happened the next year and that was tried to be used against an individual, that would be or manipulated in some way.
Mr. Chair, that would probably be considered false information if they said I didn't vote for it or I did vote for it when they didn't. I would consider that false information.
So if there was testimony saying, I believe that this is the way it should be, and then the next session they come back and say, nope, you did something different, and it was contradictory to following a law that went into place. I'll just give you an example. There's a constitutional amendment that was on the ballot that people said this will resolve pay issues for the state of Minnesota for the legislature. And now you're starting to hear a lot of people coming out and saying the first thing the legislature did when they got back was to vote themselves a pay raise. I'm just wondering if that's false advertising, given that the fact that the Constitution directs this committee to have this, if that were to show up on literature in the 2018 cycle, would that be considered false information and false advertising under this definition?
Mr. Chair, that's a lot deeper than I can answer that question.
Well, let's see what the bill author would like to do with the A3 amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess, there's a lot of questions that are raised by this. I certainly don't think that people who are running off for office should be disseminating false or misleading information, and I would be opposed to that. I know there are constitutional questions and other things like that that are raised by this amendment, but I don't have an objection to putting it onto the bill if people want to do that.
Representative Helverson, I think you also had a comment that I might have missed. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that it's important as we look at this amendment and think about the questions that are being raised in this committee that investigating potential false claims is not a new jurisdiction for the Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board. It happens regularly where information will be put out about a candidate or a campaign or a ballot issue and questions will be raised by one party or another saying, was this true or was this false? And the Campaign Finance Board does have the ability to investigate that and rule on that. So it is something that is not new to them. So for us as candidates to make the statement that we are going to make sure that we are going to be honest and forthright, I think that's really important. So it's not new for the Campaign Finance Board to be looking at honest or dishonest statements.
respond, Representative Knobloch?
I don't have any responses.
We'll go to Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this amendment just made me sort of think, if the Campaign Finance Board already has that purview, then I'm not sure why we necessarily need this. And as someone who was in a race with a lot of what I would call misleading and false information, particularly about myself, that was not done by the candidate. It was done by outside parties that, by law, you cannot coordinate with. However, the public all thought it was either coming from my campaign or my opponent's campaign, because it's very confusing to the average person to be able to understand. You have to read where it's coming from on the disclosure and in the return address label, and if it didn't have my campaign committee on it, then they wouldn't know whether it was from my campaign or my opponent's campaign or someone else, which quite frankly could have a very misleading name of their committee. So, I mean, and I don't really think it's fair to the public for them to be able to understand all the intricacies of our campaign finance laws either. You know, I understand we're held to a higher standard, and with Representative Halverson's comment, I feel like we're already held there. So I'm not sure if this amendment would address maybe what you're trying to tackle.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the comments, the latest comments, the Campaign Finance Board does investigate that, but right now they have no recourse. This would, if the candidates say false information about each other, they would lose their public subsidy. And as far as people having false information put out, I had the NRA put out false information about me in one of my campaigns. They're a group we have no control over. They're an outside group. Constitutionally, we can't do anything about that.
Right. Members, we do have a bill that's being laid over at this point, and I just want to make sure that you understand that we can, with the time that we've got left, probably not have to meet tomorrow if we want to go and continue to discuss a bill that we are going to lay over for possible inclusion. And if you've read ahead in the chapters, this isn't going to be in the DE1 amendment that we're going to be using for the vehicle. It's totally at the call of the committee. I'm your chair. I got to, I'm fine staying tonight or, coming back after session or coming back tomorrow. I'm your chair, and you can decide how you want to proceed with it at this point. So I have always been participative in letting members discuss what they want, seeing a lot of hands coming up, and some testifiers are looking to come up. It's clearly up to the members. So questions? Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to respond to Representative Peterson, I think you could not be more right in the fact that there is a lot of outside influence, a lot from coming from outside the state. Frankly, I'd like to make it illegal to print a picture that's ugly, because, man, where there's my father was shocked. That's not my girl. Because there was about $400,000 of outside money that came into my campaign to beat me up. And it's, and people who care about you and love you are like, no, that's not who you are. But we don't have a lot of recourse at this point to deal with that outside influence and outside money. As a state legislature, we do have the opportunity. I will put that out there. So, to be continued.
Representative Knobloch, what are your wishes? We can vote it on. We can vote it off. You can say no. It's up to you. Representative Nelson, you can withdraw it. I mean, we've got lots of options for today, people.
Mr. Chair, as I mentioned before, I don't have an objection to it being put on.
All right. Then all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. We'll add it to the bill, the A4 amendment. No offers of the A4 amendment? All right. Well, Representative Knobloch, thank you. And is there anyone who did not get a chance to testify on House File 1842 that wishes to? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Knobloch, we will give you the final word before they lay the bill over.
Okay, members, just one final thing people may not have thought of with this bill, which I think they should be aware of, is that since there would no longer be party designations, as you looked at having primaries and having primaries narrow the field down to two candidates for the general election, you would now have a system more similar to California's, where the top two candidates, even if they were the same party, would be running against each other in the general election. And there are some districts in this state where Democrats always win, Republicans always win, and the choice that the public then has really is decided at the convention in a lot of cases. And so I think this would give the public more choice about who that final person would be on the ballot, especially in those districts that really aren't contested between the parties. With that, members, I appreciate the conversation and appreciate your hearing the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nabok, before we leave this issue, thank you for at least raising the issue of alternative ways to deal with the people's business in the state of Minnesota through the election process and bringing people together to do the best business that they can on behalf of the people of the state of Minnesota. This is the second year you've attempted something like this, and I laud you for those efforts, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, I've authored this bill for many years going back from before you were even a member of the body, so you wouldn't remember. But it has been a position I have held for a long time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, we will move to House File 2050. Representative Nolan. Nolan West, excuse me. Representative West, if you'd like to move your bill before the committee and for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move House File 2050 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And I also have an author's amendment.
I was just going to ask if the amendment here was yours, and do you want to kind of explain the bill and the amendment, and we'll get in the form that you are looking for here today, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment clarifies that there is a printed record of the electronic sign-in, which is what the bill allows. So if a polling place chooses, it's optional, to use an electronic poll book, people can electronically record their signature, which will provide a little streamlining to the sign-in process when you go to vote. So I'd like to move the A18 amendment.
All right. The A18 amendment, you said?
Yes.
A18-0613. All right. All those in favor of the amendment to get the bill in the form that the author wishes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. To the bill as amended. Representative Wack.
So this bill allows you to electronically sign in if the polling place chooses to use an electronic poll book. So it is not a mandate for like a rural community that doesn't have internet. They will still be able to proceed as they normally do. It allows them, because we need to make it a little easier to adapt to our e-poll book system that we'd like to see most of the state go to, or I'd like to see most of the state go to. And I'd like to thank Representative Nelson for being a co-author on this bill. And any questions I'm happy to take?
Representative Nelson, you are a co-author. Did you want to speak to the matter?
Mr. Chair, thank you. The only thing I would say is that being in Hennepin County, we did use the electronic poll books as part of the pilot project. And if I remember that when we did that, you signed electronically on a pad and it did print out a receipt. So I thought that was the way it was. So I have no objection to the bill, and I think it's common sense.
And since we members last addressed this issue, we did pass $7 million in the state government finance bill and was signed by the governor to make $7 million available for election equipment and for grants for continuing with e-poll books. So this is certainly something that is timely. All right. Member questions? Seeing none, is there anyone from the public who'd like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 2050 as amended? Good morning and welcome. We'll have you proceed and provide us your name and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Geis. I am the County Auditor, Treasurer, and Property and Customer Services Director for Scott County. However, I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers today. I want to commend Representative West for bringing this bill forward. And the main reason that I feel that this is really necessary for counties, particularly as we move forward with electronic poll books more statewide, is that they are a tool that can be utilized heavily to do research on what was called out as a potential fraud case. If we have the ability to get to that record in a manner that's a lot quicker, it's a no-nonsense type of a use of technology that should be advanced. I spent, and my staff has spent hours after the 2016 as all the voter records are updated, when the when the rosters are completed and the voter registrations are done, and you have everything from all 87 counties, then of course we print a master list on, do we have people who have duplicate voter records for the same election? So what do we have to do? We have to research these to make sure that voter didn't vote twice. And in many cases, in 90% of the cases, they do not, or that statistic is even probably higher. But in order to garner that information, we have to look at those signatures. In order to get that, you bring up your cases and cases and cases of documents that you have stored away in a facility, of course, that is locked down, and you start paging through them to try to get to the signature, to try to absolutely guarantee that that signature is not a match. So this technology and having it electronically will allow us to bring up those signatures on a very easy basis. We can print those out, and we can send them to each other, whatever the other county is, and we can confirm that whether it is or is not a voter who may have fraudulently voted, and send them to get prosecuted in a timely fashion. So with that, I would like to thank the committee, thank Representative West for bringing this bill forward, and I look forward to its advancement.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Anyone else wishing to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 2050 as amended? Seeing no public testimony, seeing no member questions, Representative West, we will give you the final word, sir.
Thanks to the committee, and thanks to Cindy. She's here almost as much as we are. So I'd like to move the bill to lay over.
We will lay over House File 2050 as amended for possible inclusion in the election omnibus bill. With that, we have Representative Quam with House File 3108. Members, as an update for you here on how we were going to handle the rest of the morning's discussion, as Representative Quam is getting settled in to present his bill, 3108, we're going to revert to House File 3221. I've spoken with Representative Freiberg, and I will explain why we're going to take that last and our purpose for that. I've also asked the Secretary of State, who's been patiently waiting for us today, to participate in that conversation that's around bill of Representative Freiberg's 2179. So with that, Representative Quam, if you want to move your bill, 3108, for possible inclusion in the elections omnibus bill.
I would so move, and I would also like to entertain the small amendment.
Representative Quam moves that the House File 3108 be laid over for possible inclusion. He has an amendment, the A18-0600 amendment. Moving the amendment. Representative Quam moves the A18-0600 amendment. All those in favor to get the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
I just have a question on the, and I guess some clarification on this amendment. Having run it originally in a special election that while we were in session, and that's a 28-day election, so right now it's 2 weeks in, you have your primary, and then 2 weeks later is the general election to fill it. This would put that primary 1 week in instead of, and then so you'd then be 3 weeks later be the election. And I don't know if that'd be enough time for when it's called in a special election. So, I mean, I think this is problematic, going to the 21st day as opposed to the 14th day.
Representative Quam, to the A18-0660 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I find disenfranchisement problematic. And because we do have precincts and areas within our state that are mail-in, and because the Federal Postal Service has discontinued the regional sorting, that now many of those areas have to go, the mail gets to the local, gets sent up to the metro, and gets sorted and back. It takes additional days on each direction, and because it presently is set up that if they don't receive, it's not the postmark, if they don't receive that mailed-in ballot back election day, it is not counted. And, you know, looking at the 14 days, you take away 2 days for certification, you take away another day to get printing. If you've got a primary, you've got, I'm not sure if the printer is delivering to the post office on a Saturday. You've got Sundays where there's no activity in the Postal Service. And you've got very commonly 4 or more days for each route. So you've got 8 more days there. You've got a day for residual, which is in many places, you get the mail out of your mailbox, and you mail it the next day. So there's a delay in if you voted right away. So there were people that did not receive in this last election their mail ballot until the day they would have had to have had it mailed in to be received in time. And that is without any possible other delays caused by, weather, which in Minnesota we have those type of things. So in order to assure that we don't disenfranchise people that are in rural areas that are a mail-in precinct, that is the intent of this, is to allow their voice to be handled with the process we've had.
Representative Nelson.
Well, Mr. Chair, along that same logic, if in a special election called while we were in session for one of our seats, again, it's a 28-day election, and it's so 1 week in, people wouldn't even have a chance to get mailed out an absentee ballot, period, because it's called, the governor has 5 days to call the election after the vacancy occurs, then the election is 28 days, so 1 week in, before people even know who the candidates are, you'd be having a primary. I don't think that's enough time for all that to happen, to get ballots out, to get even ballots out for people for a special election for the primary. You're talking, what you're talking on the back end after the primary, we're still having that issue. We only have 1 week to do all that he's talking about to get out for the primary in that special election. And that's why, that's why it's problematic in this case here. I don't know if there's a way to fix that, if this for other ones that are held when there are more time, but we're talking your special election's called, a week later you're having a primary election. I think that's problematic, and again, we're going to disenfranchise voters because they're not going to, number one, know the election's going on, who the candidates are, or have the ability to get a mail-in ballot for that. That's what I'm concerned about.
Sure, sure. Other discussion on the A18-0600 to get it in the form that the author would like. Seeing none, we'll take the vote. All those in favor of the A18-0600 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. As amended, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, it became evident that, in the special election when it was on a Monday, people are used to showing up Monday for elections. If they had chosen a Wednesday instead of a Monday, at least the people that showed up on Tuesday as a normal election would have been told, hey, it's tomorrow. But it being on a Monday, it's even more problematic. And I think for consistency, the legislature found it reasonable to try and set a few consistent days through the year for elections, and that passed this past year. I think it's only appropriate that we make it more realistic, consistent for our constituents who have busy lives to be able to, we go to the poll on Tuesday. And that's the intent of this bill, is for that consistency.
Members, questions on the bill as amended? Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, my experience of having run in a special election that was on a Monday, and I do agree with the fact that it's most people are used to voting on a Tuesday, and a Monday in March is not a day the normal people are used to going to vote.
Representative Nelson, if I could, without interrupting your thought, they're thinking about a different madness at that time of the year.
Yes, exactly. The only other thing I said with this last special election, I believe it was held on a Monday because Tuesday was our precinct caucus night, and I don't think we could have had an election on precinct caucus day. So that's, again, by designating only Tuesday. There might be situations where that's the only day possible. But
you're exactly right, Representative Nelson, when you talk about it being problematic. And my recollection wasn't precinct caucuses. There was another small school board election that was going on in one of the overlapping districts that there might have been confusion about which polling place to go because of designation and things. And Representative Quam, I will just share, and I don't usually share my thoughts specifically on bills, but I tend to agree with the general idea. If someone were to have showed up on a Tuesday thinking that that's the day, they would have been there. If it was on a Wednesday and they showed up on a Tuesday, they would still have the chance. If you showed up on a Tuesday and they said that was yesterday, that's disenfranchisement. And I think that that's what you are trying to solve, and that's a very noble and laudable goal, I believe, on that idea. I don't think anybody would disagree with that idea. With that, Representative Quam, I don't have any other member questions. I will ask if there is public testimony on House File 3108 as amended. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House File 3108 as amended? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Quam, we will give you the final word before we lay it over.
And lay over the bill.
All right. With that, I will lay over House File 3108 as amended. And as I said, we're going to revert right now to the elections bill to take care of that. And then I want to spend the remainder of the time on the Representative Freiberg matter and bringing Secretary of State Simon into the conversation as well. With that, I'm going to turn over the gavel temporarily to Vice Chair Pugh as I make my way down to the testifiers table. And Mr. Gehring, I'm going to, I'm sorry, put the chair to recognize him.
Yes. Welcome to the testifier stand, Mr. Chair, at your committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I would like to do is ask Mr. Gehring to help us to walk through the contents of the DE1 amendment and the other amendments that we have so that we can take this in the proper order. So with that, I would like to turn to nonpartisan staff to help us with the construction and dissemination of the information. So, Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair and committee members, so in the packet, you should have the House Research Bill Summary that lists the specific bills that were included in this DE amendment. And in the interest of time, Mr. Chair, do you want me to walk through section by section?
Do you want to just get the highlights on what we were looking at? Yeah. That would be helpful, Mr. Gehring. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, so in this DE amendment, there are four bills that have been incorporated. The first bill, and the bill that takes the most content of the amendment, is Representative O'Driscoll's technical elections administration bill that we heard yesterday in committee. Also included is House File 1569. This is Representative Peterson's voting systems bill that includes her A2 amendment that was adopted yesterday. House File 2050 is Representative West's bill that we just heard a few minutes ago. And then also Representative Quam's bill, House File 3108, which is the Tuesday special election language.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gehring, before we proceed, are there any technical corrections in the DE as it stands that we should be taking in the way of oral amendments?
Mr. Gehring.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, so there's one drafting correction that I would that I spoke with the Secretary of State's office about yesterday. This has to do with Representative Mason's question that she asked in the discussion yesterday about write-in candidates. So if you look at the DE1 amendment on page 5, there's the language that authorizes cities to require candidates or write-in candidates to request that their votes be counted. And the question that Representative Mason raised was whether the language here that requires the verification of whether a write-in vote total is equal to or greater than the number of votes for a non-write-in candidate on the ballot made sense. And I think communicate with Secretary of State's office, I think what we would suggest is on line 5.10, delete the word candidate and insert office. So the effect of that is that to test whether you count write-in votes or not, you verify whether the total number of all write-in votes for the office is greater than the fewest number of non-write-in votes for a ballot candidate. So the oral amendment would be 5.10, delete candidate, and insert office.
Representative Driscoll, would you like to move that?
Madam Chair, I would move the oral amendment to strike the word candidate on 5.10 and insert the word office on 5.10.
There's been a motion to delete the word candidate on line 5.10 and insert the word office. Any discussion on that oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and the oral amendment is adopted to the DE1 amendment. You want to do A4? Okay. And Representative O'Driscoll, shall we look at the A4 amendment?
Yes,
and
Madam
add
Chair.
That to the DE1 amendment?
Madam Chair, please, and I would ask nonpartisan staff to explain the amendment.
Mr. Gehring?
Madam Chair, committee members, the A4 amendment is just an identical amendment to the amendment Representative West offered just a few minutes ago to reflect the way his bill as laid over was amended in this committee. So it's adding the section related to electronic signatures.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. And Representative West, would you like to make any comments since this is your amendment?
No. Just move it and put it on.
Okay. So would you like to move the A4 amendment be adopted to the DE1?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A4 amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor of amending the A4 amendment onto the DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the A4 amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, those are the only amendments that I have and are aware of. From a technical standpoint, to get the bill, the DE1 amendment, in the form that I, as the chair, would like to have as a 2018 omnibus elections bill.
So, Representative O'Driscoll, do you want to continue any further discussion?
There is an A5 amendment, and I, like I said, that's not my amendment. I don't know if anybody's planning to offer the A5, but it is in members' packet. And it's a similar topic to what we discussed
earlier
on a different bill.
Representative Nelson?
Seeing as how we've already litigated that, I think we can just let it go. We don't need to do it a second time.
All right, so then I see no other further amendments. Representative Driscoll, do you have any testifiers to your bill? Or?
Madam Chair, at this point, we have had robust testimony over the last 2 days on these topics and the matters. What I'd like to do right now is I'd like to move the DE1 amendment to House File 3221 as amended. To House File 3221 to get the bill in the shape that I would like it to be.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, we will move that the DE1 amendment be amended to House File 3221. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
Motion. Madam Chair, for the record, at the end of today, when we do vote on this, I would like to be referred to the General Register. That is its final destination today.
General Register. All right. Is there any public testimony on this bill before we move forward? Okay. I guess enough of robust discussion has already happened. So Representative O'Driscoll renews his motion that House File 3221, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and you're on your way, Representative.
Members, thank you for your work on the bill this year, and to Representative Nelson as the co-author. Greatly appreciated.
And next we have up Representative Freiberg for House File 2179.
Members, the reason that I wanted to spend some time today discussing the bill that Representative Freiberg has, and one of the reasons why it's not being included as a part of the 2018 elections bill, and I'm going to give just a little bit of background on this, is this is a topic that when Secretary Simon was Chair Simon of the Elections Committee, and I was on the Elections Committee, we were dealing with this. Representative Freiberg has been on the committee and has dealt with this, and so has this committee. But we still maintain some, I will call, problematic areas in vacancy and nomination. And Representative Freiberg has a bill that he introduced last session, and I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to discuss that. I think it's very important that this committee does not lose track of what that topic is and how that can affect the outcome of elections in Minnesota and the process. So, Representative Freiberg, with that, we are not going to take action on 2179, but we'll certainly bring it before the committee at this point. I'm going to ask you to go ahead and share your background, and then we'll also ask the Secretary of State to come down. And then what I want to do is I want to have some discussion as members on this as we finish up our elections discussion for the year. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you,
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this issue and present this bill. And I appreciate the work that you and other legislators and Secretary Simon have done on this issue. I know it's an issue we've been trying to get right for a long time, and you know the way some of these things work is like you pass a law and then the situation you don't quite anticipate comes up, and then you realize maybe the law needs to be tweaked a little bit more. I think this is one of those areas. And it's because of a situation that arose shortly after the 2016 election where a candidate for the state legislature was found by a court to not reside in the district. But this occurred after the deadline for withdrawing his name from the ballot. And this is a problem that could apply potentially with either situation. And I see, and so under state law, what happens in that circumstance is that the election for that district is essentially nullified. It's rescheduled as a special election in February. And I see a couple problems potentially with that system. So first of all, it kind of penalizes the candidate who of the other party, presumably, who's acting in good faith, who resides in the district, who has no issues. It causes the district to go unrepresented for a few months, which, is a problem, I believe, for those residents of that district. And potentially a bigger issue is it's potentially subject to abuse. I can envision a situation, and I've spoken to other legislators of both parties who see this potentially as a problem. You could have ineligible candidates filing in districts. They ultimately get removed from the ballot, and then at the beginning of the legislative session, there's no representatives for potentially multiple districts. And so it seems like it's a situation that requires some sort of solution. I don't know if this is the perfect solution. I think it makes sense. And it doesn't apply in the case, the three situations where this can happen are in the case of the death of a candidate, the serious illness of a candidate, or the in what happened in this circumstance, a candidate is ruled ineligible to run by a court because of residency or other reasons. So this only applies in that third category where their candidate has been ruled ineligible by a court. What it says, the bill is pretty simple. It just says if that happens, if a court rules that the candidate is ineligible, the board has to disregard the vote totals for the candidate determined to be ineligible, but certifies the votes for all other eligible candidates for that office. This means that the good faith candidate who could be of any party is still able to run. There is still a potential for the party of the candidate who was excluded, who could be a third party, to have mount a write-in campaign. Those are successful occasionally. So there is, and the district will not go unrepresented. So that's what the bill does. I don't know how you'd like to proceed, if you'd like questions to happen now, or I know you wanted the secretary to come up here as well. I have spoken to the secretary, I should say, and I know they're not opposed to this approach.
Right, and Representative Freiberg, if you'd like to go back to your seat, and we'll just bring the secretary down, and then we can have that discussion, because I do want to give some additional background why I think this is such an important public policy position and what we have been able to do as a group to move this forward and with some of the challenges that we have in the future. Mr. Secretary, welcome, and we do appreciate you taking your time again to be here with us this week on this particular matter. As I've mentioned, you and I have some long history on this particular matter, so maybe you would want to go ahead with some comments, and I'll share some comments, and I do want to bring it open for you and us to have a conversation on that topic this morning. Mr. Secretary, welcome. To identify yourself and proceed.
Sure. Steve Simon, Secretary of State. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I was just asked this morning to come here and maybe share a little historical perspective, and you and I share that, and so does at least one other member on this committee, which I'll mention in a minute. So my, at least, historical perspective of this is let's start with the death of Paul Wellstone. And we talked about this, you and I did, in the 13-14 session when you and I were serving alongside one another about kind of the Wellstone issue. What happens when a few days before an election a candidate dies? In that instance, those of us who remember that in 2002, Senator Wellstone died 11 days before the election, the Tuesday before the Tuesday. And the rule at that time was that his political party, the DFL party, had to come up with a nominee. The election was not postponed. It was still going to happen 11 days later. So they hurried up, and they came up with former Vice President Mondale. Obviously, he lost that election.
Mr. Secretary, I just have to draw a little closer to the microphone.
Yeah, sure.
Kind of
cutting
it out. Thank you.
Yep. So one lingering question was that issue of the Wellstone issue, let's call it that. Somebody dies shortly before the election. And the law at that time was there was no postponement. His political party had to nominate someone quickly on a hurry-up basis to campaign for the remaining 9 or 10 days at that point. And so that was sort of simmering for a while. And then all of us at the time in the legislature were reminded again of its importance when a member of this body, a member of the House, resigned after the cutoff date in September of the election year, I believe, because of a personal scandal. And the court ruled, well, there's no reason why the election has to be postponed. The party would, again, have the opportunity to nominate someone. So we decided in the 2013 session, you and I and some others decided on a bicameral, bipartisan basis, let's come up with a solution to this that makes the most sense. There's no perfect solution. There's always going to be a disadvantage. But let's come up with a solution. And we had a working group consisting of legislators from all four caucuses and representatives from the two major political parties, and that's where I met Representative Fenton, who wasn't Representative Fenton yet. She was the representative because she was vice chair of the statewide GOP. She was the representative in these working group matters, so that's why I knew her before she served. And so you and I and then Representative Sanders, and I can't remember who some of the others were, we met a number of times with people from the Secretary of State's office.
President Halverson, I think, might have been involved in some of those discussions as well.
That might be. I just can't remember all the players. And so what we came up with at the time, this is 2013, was a rule that said, in the case of death or incapacity, and I recall elements of the law saying you had to have not one but two doctors attesting that this really wasn't incapacity. In the case of death or incapacity, you would have a special election 91 days later, so in February, basically. So if there's a plane crash or a horrible medical diagnosis or a disfigurement or something that affected the person's capacity to perform the job, then there would be a special election 91 days later. So my understanding and memory of what happened in 2015 is that I'm getting the historical steps. So in 2015, in 2015, we added to that. In other words, the things that kick, what belongs in the basket of things that would kick it to 91 days later? We added
the issue of if
you identify yourself.
That's right. We added the issue of, that's right, yeah.
This, Julie Strother, rather from the Secretary.
Right, exactly.
Thank
so
you.
We added, that's right, now I'm getting it right. So then we added in 2015 that issue. If there's a disqualification, then that too is in that basket of things that kicks to 91 days. So my understanding of Representative Freiberg's bill is it would, in essence, go back to the 13 legislation. It would reverse the change that was made in 2015 to add to the special election basket someone being disqualified. So that's the historical perspective. And, Mr. Chair, you may, if I forgot a detail or if I failed to mention something, mention it. But that's what the working group came up with, knowing, by the way, and understanding. And I think Representative Freiberg is quite right, and everyone is, to come up with hypotheticals of ways that could be abused, frankly. And you could have the situation where there's a major statewide office holder who's in ahead in the polls by, 20, 30 percentage points, and then his or her opponent, major party opponent, let's say, God forbid, gets hit by a bus in October, that person won't be seated. There would have to be a special election in February. There are all sorts of hypotheticals. So I think at the time, though, we were conscious of that. I think you'll agree, Mr. Chair, but we thought, well, out of the range of unsatisfactory options, this one seemed to be the fairest one, or the one at least that both major political parties, members of all four legislative caucuses, could agree on. Not perfect, but probably the best.
And Mr. Secretary, since you've referenced Representative Fenton, she is on this committee. Yes. I'd also like to get her historical perspective on this before I share mine. Representative Fenton.
I would just concur, Mr. Chair, that Mr. Secretary is, in fact, correct on that perspective of how this all came about. And I know this was definitely not – this was a very difficult task at the time when we were tackling it, but that's my perspective.
And Representative
– I guess Mr. Secretary, you've read the current bill that we're discussing right now, correct? I mean, I have a serious concern because I'm a huge proponent of due process, and I think that – we're taking that away. If we go back to the previous 2013, we're taking that away with the current bills in the way it's written.
Yeah, and don't know if it's necessary, though. There was another idea that was out to try to solve what seems to be a perennial problem that we just cannot solve as a state of Minnesota. I don't know if any state has got a perfect solution to this. I will give you some additional insight and background on this. In the 2014 cycle, there were, as filings closed, there were at least two situations that I can think of, possibly three, where there were two candidates that had filed, both of them having to do with or involved in political parties, but then shortly, like within a day or so after the filing deadline closed, one pulled out in one race and one pulled out in the other, leaving two people unopposed. And one of them had to, I'm more familiar with one of them than I am with the other, because one of them was my race that this happened in. And what was determined at that time was, okay, you are a candidate. The other candidate, which was a, I believe, a Green Party candidate that had pulled out, it was determined that there would be an extension of the deadline for filing for the Green Party to bring a replacement candidate in. No other party had that opportunity to enter the race, but because there was an individual that had filed in that race, had withdrawn, it was determined. In the second race, it was a GOP and a DFL. The DFL had pulled out, so the DFL had a chance to put another candidate in there. That very next session, I went to then-Secretary Simon, and I said, we still have a problem. And I said, I really can't be the one to champion this because I am pretty closely connected with this. And I was always public with like I am today in committee with that. But what we quickly determined was, and the words that the secretary used were, we've got to prevent people from being able to game the system. And gaming the system means, well, now we know who the players are. Let's drop one of these folks out, convince them to pull out, and put somebody else in that we think would be a better suited candidate. And we do not want that happening around the state of Minnesota. So that's where the 2014 fix had come in. And then we evolved to the 2015-2016 issues, which are continuing to be progressing. Representative Fenton had a situation, although not being in a statewide race or in a legislative race, but in Washington County, that we were able to fix last year in legislation to help. She had a situation where she had a county commissioner, where there are five county commissioners, if I'm not mistaken, in Washington County. One of them had died, and there were four of the county commissioners there. There was an entire district within Washington County that was going unrepresented, and the other four were having, by default, more influence on what was happening in Washington County at the expense of no voice of this particular district that didn't have a member. We had to wait for the next general election to do that. I see Representative Joachim has left, but she is very, very big on pointing out at the local level, the cities, you can do appointing on that. And so it's not as much of an issue at that level to be able to do an appointment. So let's scale that back up to the legislative situation where you have a legislature that doesn't meet all year. You have a legislature that meets during a defined period of time, defined by Constitution in the first year of the biennium, and then by agreement in the second year of the biennium. So here we have somebody who could have died or passed away on the very first day or shortly before the start of session, and we have to wait now for the governor to declare an election, and we have to go through that process. I don't know about other members around this table, but I get a lot of emails. And so those folks that are in that particular district are going to still try to maybe email the person who was the person that was in that, hoping someone there and the other and could help. And so there isn't anyone to advocate for those people. We're very concerned about disenfranchisement. I don't know that we're going to have a solution today, but the reason I bring this forward is I want to hear from other members with their thoughts and comments on this, and I also want to just make the comment. We do have an election this fall, and elections bring new majorities potentially or sustained majorities or different splits between majorities and minorities. This committee needs to, regardless of who's in control, needs to continue to keep this in the forefront and to continue to advocate for disenfranchisement to voters, whether that has to be with the disability community or what we're talking about in election processes. With that, I'm going to revert to Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr.
Secretary, you're next. Mm-hmm.
Yep, I just wanted to clarify, too, that this, you know, there were a couple scenarios mentioned, one by the Secretary about the death of a candidate who was polling very well, One by yourself, Mr. Chair, about candidates potentially gaming the system by withdrawing so that a stronger candidate come on. This bill would not allow, just for the benefit of the audience at home, this bill would not allow either of those situations to occur. This or doesn't relate to either of those situations. It's only where the language on 213 and 214 is very specific. It's where a court order determines that the candidate is ineligible to hold office. And to me, that has the potential for the system to be gamed under the scenario I described when I was up there.
Mr. Secretary and Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to belabor the point or lengthen the deliberations here, but I fear I'm about to, maybe, by introducing one thing for – this is convenient, right? I can drop this bomb and then leave the room and you can figure it out.
Somebody get the sergeant's office and prevent the secretary from leaving.
But let me say this, and Ms. Rother and I have discussed this, and I think we've discussed it with you and other members. Maybe not for today, but on an ongoing basis, this is an ongoing issue that you and your committee is going to be looking at, and all legislators will, you know, to stop the gaming of the system, as we've been describing it, you could, it'd be tough to administer, I admit, but one possible idea is to put a fraud exception in there. Now, is that susceptible of proof? What is the standard of proof? I don't know. But if you can prove that someone knowingly challenged a legislator knowing that they're ineligible, knowing that they were going to cause this special election, doing it for the purpose of doing that. Or someone who said, I'm eligible now. My plan is I'm going to file against O'Driscoll, and what I'm going to do is I know I'm going to be accepting this job in September. So I'm going to move, and I'm eligible now, so I'm not breaking the law, but I know I'm going to take this job, and I won't have been a resident of the district for 30 days by the time November comes around. Something like that, some fraud exception. Again, fraud is difficult and tricky to prove, but that is one aspect of the problem you might choose to address, either in this bill or in the future. There are pitfalls, but it is one avenue of inquiry, I would say.
Hmm. Representative Halverson.
Is anybody else's head spinning with potential ways that this could play out? This is very complicated, and I think that the fact that it's been dealt with legislature after legislature says that we're working on progress, not perfection. And I think that Secretary Simon, you raise an interesting point with regard to proving intent. I think that the situation that was raised with the Chisago County election was that the case went to court and the person was determined to be ineligible. I think that there was some knowing ineligible there because it had actually been brought up numerous times over the course of many years, the residency question. And so maybe that's the threshold because we did end up with people who did not have a representative, which I found concerning. And we did end up with a candidate who had worked for many, many months who was just kind of left high and dry and had to run a special election. And so is that the best the question for me is not about the candidate so much as what is the best solution for the citizens so that they get their voices heard and so that they have representation. And so I do think that perhaps finding some standards, and maybe there are some standards because this did go through the courts, makes perhaps some sense. But I think that that's what we're trying to get to with this bill. At least that's part of my interest in this bill. So just throwing it out there, I don't have the answer, but I think that we need to keep considering it.
Representative Halverson, if you did have the answer and withholding it from us, we would not be happy. Again, if there's others that would like to comment on this and members of the public, if there's anyone that would like to take a few minutes to share thoughts, having heard the discussion, we're willing to do that as well. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, in my time here, I know of one election that the Democrat and Republican filed, and Republican pulled out within the five-day period, leading only the Democrat in the race unopposed. And the Democrat had been thinking about withdrawing himself and didn't because now there would have been nobody in the race. And then after the partway through the first year of the term, ended up taking a job out of state and having to resign and, again, setting up a special election. So there's all sorts of circumstances that can happen. I don't think we can ever get it perfect. But I, if we were going to go forward with this before we would pass something like this, I think we should go with another working group or commission to look at it, do some, you know, trying to figure out get around it, because we can all sit around and speculate of what if this happened, what if that happened. Having been elected in the Wellstone year, that was problematic and caused other repercussions through the whole election cycle. The one earlier with the governor candidate withdrew because of personal issues, caused repercussions through the whole election cycle that year, not just in that race. So it's, I don't know how we can do this and get it done perfectly. It's like you said, it's a tough needle to thread.
Representative Nelson, your points are well made. And again, I wanted to bring this to the committee's attention once again because we haven't dealt with it this year. The problems still exist. And I haven't been around here as long as some, but more than others. And I have learned over the years that there will be something that will be popping up this election cycle, not necessarily nefarious, but just popping up where we go, oh, well, we got to deal with that in the next election cycle. And we haven't finished this one yet. Mr. Secretary, and then I'll come back to Representative
Mr. Chair, I would just say, I just want to say it for the record, if you think our office would be useful in either being part of or helping to convene such a working group, we're happy to do it. By the same token, my tender feelings will not be hurt if you or the committee also determine that it's best left just to a legislative matter, but we're happy to offer our services.
Mr. Secretary, that may be a good place in which to start in the interim on this to at least get some paperwork on the desk. My wishes would be that this is bipartisan and bicameral, so I'm not sure if the Senate is spending any time addressing this issue in their agenda for elections or not, but I wanted to just bring that forward for our consideration. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my former senator, Senator Scheid, was active and helped write after the gubernatorial race, the changes that were there, and then there was part and parcel of solving the working on the issue when Wellstone passed away. And so I've heard from her many different times in the past. She had many opinions, but it's like you said, it's going to be a tough thing. I don't know if this is the perfect solution. I don't think any solution would be perfect.
And with that, if there aren't any other thoughts or comments, the only other thought I have, Mr. Secretary, and we may want to visit with as principals from the different committees in your office at some point on the matter. But here's something else to consider, maybe seeing what other states are doing and how they maybe have, if there's some best practices or some things we could bring to the table to make a better practice here in Minnesota. Mr. Others, is there anything that you wanted to share, or were you just the phone a friend today?
Phone a friend.
Very good. Members of the GOP, we are going to be meeting in my office at, we'll do 12:05 to huddle. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you. Oh, and no meeting tomorrow.
Yay.
Oh, wait a minute. Do we have to meet because I didn't?
Nope.
We are canceled. I just wanted to see who was still paying attention. Again, GOP members.